Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Remembering Sophia Hillman Giegrich and the post-Jungian theologics. Before continuing with Sophia's story, we need to pause and ponder three big words: theology, mythology, and psychology. Theology, mythology, and psychology. Last night, I was using religious language. How does this all stir in to the plot here? Where does the story of Sophia fall, play, in relation to those other big words? A little over a year ago, after I concluded a short talk about Jung and eco-psychology, a talk that had tortured me beyond belief in the month or so I spent trying to compose it, a dear friend told me that when I spoke about Jung, I reminded him of a Methodist preacher. He asked if perhaps I thought Jung was God. It was a very uncomfortable question, both to ask and to answer. But it needed to be asked, and it needed to be answered. It was exactly the question I needed to face at that moment. It was painfully therapeutic. It touched at the core of less conscious issues that had been plaguing me as I was struggling in the past to compose that talk. The question forced me, over the last year and a half or so, into a confrontation with what I was doing and how I was doing it. Was I a preacher riding the salvation circuit trying to save souls through the gospel of Carl Gustav Jung? Preachers preach theology. Or at least preach in behalf of a belief in theology, or a faith in affirmations of theologies. However, the fact is, I've never been particularly good at belief, and I've never had much faith in other people's beliefs. Perhaps as a result, I developed a fairly deep-seated aversion to theology and faith affirmations. Or so I believed. And now the question: had I too become a theologian? Had I been possessed by my own ministerial and theological shadows? Was I putting a theology into my reading of Jung? Damn good question. At least it was the question I had to ask. For the first time in years, I started looking beyond Jung's work and reading what others were saying about Jung and about his psychology. I had not paid much attention to that secondary literature in 15 or 20 years, really. My interest had increasingly focused entirely on Jung's work and the historical record that surrounded him. Without fully understanding that primary record, itself a consuming task, how could one possibly evaluate the validity or value of the secondary commentary on his work? So as the years went on, I found that this primary material was far more interesting and personally helpful to me than the derivative commentaries and critiques about Jung. And from the perspective I was developing in my own study of source materials, much of the derivative writings appeared to woefully misinterpret or misunderstand Jung. So our discussions here also gave me some further impetus to take a new look around. You guys helped open some of this up. And I recognized that I truly needed more perspective, like the little moth larvae, you know, in the Persian rug, you're sitting there eating along, eating, and says, oh, I'm eating blue today. Oh, it's red. Oh, I'm eating green today. The world is blue. The world is red. Now the world is green. And then all of a sudden it molts. And a little moth flies up in the sky and looks down and says, holy mackerel. It's blue, it's red, it's green. It's a pattern of things. Well, I'd spent a long time molting. And I needed to step back and examine the larger picture, the big Persian rug, the scene 100 years after Jung wrote his Red Book and 52 and a half years after he died. Dr. Miller's then forthcoming presentations on the post-Jungians that were delivered here in our forum were another coincident spur to thinking again about some of these things. Particularly about the so-called post-Jungian psychologists. Particularly James Hillman, who I'd read some, a fair amount, and Wolfgang Gigrich, who I had avoided reading almost entirely. David Miller's seminars subsequently added, when he came and spoke with us last fall, a personal insight to these writings. I mean, he knew these guys for 40 years. He worked with them. He worked with their work in supporting their work. And sometimes that personal element added to whatever you read in text is very helpful. And it was very helpful. So take this as my interim report. Again, Lance leaves his cave, Lance molts, flies to the sky, and looks at the Persian rug. So I began my wanderings wondering what the Jungites and post-Jungites out in the world were thinking and saying these days, and particularly after the Red Book's publication. Were they preaching true religion? Or, alternatively, were they rebutting and repudiating the gospel of Jung and its saving grace? What were they doing? And among many recognitions that came, I was startled by how often theological terminology entered into the readings in post-Jungian psychology. So at the start of this wandering about, I crossed path in my library with Hillman's classic 1971 essay, which was titled Psychology, Monotheism or Polytheism, which I had really not seen in a couple of decades. This was a signal work in the development of Hillman's archetypal psychology. This is the essay that spurred the revolt or revision, which was subsequently known as post-Jungian psychology. And how important that essay was is really only apparent now when we look back 40 years. Met anew, the title of the paper immediately struck me in a new way. There it was in bold title letters. Hillman signaled his movement towards a post-Jungian psychology by reflecting upon traditional theological categories. Psychology, monotheism or polytheism. Theisms and their inherent theologics. Almost immediately, Dr. David Miller added a theologically informed voice to the discussion with his influential book, The New Polytheism, published, I believe, first in 1973. In that book, Miller republished Hillman's essay, Psychology, Monotheism, or Polytheism. Later, Hillman, writing of this essay, acknowledged, quote, this piece has been a groundwork for what came later, as David L. Miller was the first to espy. Miller was among the first to understand Hillman was doing, what he was up to. Over the next decade, James Hillman and David Miller spoke together on this subject at several conferences, and I believe the first was in 1976 at a meeting of the American Academy of Religions. American Academy of Religions. Hillman later noted, in his grumpy way, that the context of the discussions in these forums was primarily theological and not psychological. In an epilogue to his original paper, which he added in 1981, and which was published, I think, in the next edition of David Miller's book, Hillman reflected on the responses and discussions that had ensued over the decade since original publication of his paper. He explained, and I quote, "What I have suggested as a polytheistic psychology has inescapably been taken as a polytheistic theology, whose target is Christianity and Judeo-Christian monotheism. The psychological issue here is not whether this was or was not my aim, disguised or plain, but rather, can one do psychology without at the same time doing theology?" As one past discussant of the paper noted, this was precisely the dilemma of Jungian psychology. It uses religious categories for describing the psychic world, and hence is willy-nilly entangled in theology. Hillman goes on, speaking of this discussant, "He is right. The Jungian context of this piece," now speaking of his original paper, "is nowhere more visible than in the deliberate interpenetration of psychology and theology. Jung's psychology always has theological implications, and where it was often ignored by psychiatrists, it was vividly, even rabidly, engaged with by theologians." The collaboration in this book of Miller's, The New Polytheism, between him, Corbin, and myself, exhibits the interpenetration of theology and a psychology of soul. If we want to move psychology and therapy, we have to move its baggage too. End quote. So Hillman makes clear that the interpenetration of psychology and theology in his paper was deliberate. And then he continues, "Jung's psychology always has theological implications, and where it was often ignored by psychiatrists, it was vividly, even rapidly, engaged with by theologians." And he concluded his remarks again saying, "We have to move the theological baggage too." So that one sentence in the middle of all that really struck me. Jung's psychology always has theological implications. Does it? I've been considering that for a while. And I think this is distinctly Hillman's reading and perhaps a misreading. It's perhaps a cast in the wrong direction. But the assumption in that assertion is widely accepted. Perhaps even unquestioned. In my opinion, this reading by Hillman tainted his response to Jung and his development of archetypal psychology. And we may talk a little bit about that later. Next, along with the rest of you, last year I took up on my walkabout with Wolfgang Giegrich. I have discovered now that there are three clans in amongst the Jungites, shall I say, of today. The first clan, and perhaps the much larger one, does not know who Wolfgang Gigrich is. The second clan knows his name and disdains him, whether or not they have read him. Yeah. And the third clan, of small but perhaps increasing size, considers Gigrich the one true psychologist and the true successor of Jung and James Hillman. So, for those of you who may identify with that first clan and know nothing about the man, let me give a very brief introduction. Gigrich was born in Germany in 1942. He studied at the University of Würzburg and the University of Göttingen. And subsequently, he obtained his PhD from the University of California at Berkeley. And I believe he took his degree in comparative literature. I think that's what David told me. I didn't know that. He undertook his analytic training from the C.G. Jung Institute in Stuttgart. And since the early 1970s, which was about the time he finished his doctoral degree, he has been a prolific writer and lecturer on psychology. He's now amassed a resume with approximately 200 publications in several languages. These writings have, however, appeared mostly in specialized journals with extremely modest circulations. In addition, he has authored 14 books, most of which have enjoyed extremely limited sales, and perhaps even more limited reading or comprehension. He is founder of the International Society of Psychology as the discipline of interiority, which now forwards his work, and currently he resides in Berlin. That said, Wolfgang Gigrich is both a polarizing and also a defining figure in post-Jungian psychology. He deserves a reading. He forces one to rethink what one thinks, if one thinks at all, about Jung. At very least, after attempting to read him, you will be better prepared to identify your clan among the modern-day Jungites. Michael Kaplan, an articulate member of the aforementioned third clan, commented recently on his own initiation by Gigrich, following upon his conversion to post-Jungian psychology at the hand of Hillman. He writes, quote, "Hillman's revolt prepared me, ably and poetically, for the next move. For what I would now say is the final move. Gigrich completed the revolution and the world itself in the possibility of its comprehension and conceptual articulation. The world itself is now different. No restoration, no going back." End quote. And that's the type of post-Jungian rhetoric surrounding Wolfgang Gigrich's revolution. However, I must warn that reading Gigrich is seldom reported to be a pleasant endeavor. Some of you can perhaps respond from your own experience there. My own initiation into the reading of Gigrich was accompanied by a nightmare. I went out into the... I have a rock out in the desert that I hide under in the summer. And when I started reading Gigrich, I realized I just needed to get away. I needed to just get into this stuff. I couldn't... If I was in my house and I had something else to do and I was reading Gigrich, I'd go do something else. So I figured if I went to the desert, I could concentrate. And I figured the best time to concentrate on Gigrich was under blinding heat of the August sun. Well, it was only 105. So I went out to my rock way south in the San Rafael Desert. And it's a big rock, and it has shade, so I can all day long. You have to, if you're in the desert, you need a cave or you need shade in August. And this particular rock stays cool. It's big, so I can hide around the back side of the rock. In the morning, as the sun changes, I can go to the other side and stay in the shade. And so I took Giegrich out there and was reading for a few days and just doing that. The second night I was out there, and this is all alone, by the way, this part of the desert, there isn't another human being in 100 square miles. It's at the end of nowhere, really. My road, I won't even tell you where it is. No one goes to my place. So I went to bed in my little desert tent, and I had a dream. And it was a nightmare. I was suddenly confronted by three individuals. A man and who had a rather thin face and a little beard. And there was a woman to each side of him. But the women looked absolutely lifeless. They looked like the association I had the next morning when I thought about it is they looked like high fashion models on a runway at a fashion show. You know, this entirely blank, gaunt look, no expression at all. Sort of zombie-like. These were at each side of the man, of the fellow. And they came up off across the horizon of the desert in my dream and came to me, and I was really frightening in the dream. And the man said, "We have come for your dead. We have come for your dead." And this terrified me. And my response was immediately that to prepare battle lines. And the next thing in the dream, it was like battlements were being prepared and defense positions were being created. And like a huge war was about to take place because these people, and my impression was, you will not have my dead. And then I awoke in an absolute panic at 3:30 in the morning alone in the desert. So what the hell was this? And I don't have dreams like, I don't have terrifying or scary dreams very often. Very, very unusual for me to awaken in fright from a dream. So the next day I was sitting out there thinking about this dream. And I realized as I was thinking about it, I made no connection immediately of the dream and my reading. And the next day as I was sitting there having my iced coffee, watching the sun come up, I realized that the fellow in the dream, the dream was very clear, still is clear in my mind, looked exactly like the only picture I had at that point seen of Dr. Giegrich. So what the hell? What's going on here? So, you know, like, telling a dream to a bunch of shrinks is like, you know, slashing your chest and jumping into a pool of sharks. So, there you have it, folks. So despite bad dreams, I persisted. And indeed, perhaps because of the dream, I was more compelled to try to figure out what was going on. What was going on in this walkabout in the desert with Wolfgang? Why this haunting image? Was this a manifestation of part of my shadow issues? Pretty shadowy. And I was very defensive. Eventually I determined, as I continued my reading, that the key to Giegrich was grasping hard on to his idiosyncratic syntax, a syntactic style alien to most readers of Jung. Giegrich is all about syntax or logical structure. It is also useful while reading Giegrich to remember that he has declared the death of meaning. Thus, in a quasi-logical extension, if meaning is dead, Giegrich's work can have no meaning either. No meaning and no semantics. Just the pure truth of logical syntax. Unless, of course, he is both declaring the death and the resurrection of meaning, with Giegrich serving as the logician of the resurrection. In supplement to his book, several long essays by Giegerich appeared in recent issues of Spring Journal, which for years has been a major journal of Jungian thought. In fact, James Hillman was the editor for many years of Spring. A lot of his work appeared in Spring. And Giegerich has been a frequent contributor to Spring in the last few years. Spring also publishes his books. So I took a look at those essays, and the first essay I went looking for was his review of the Red Book. Giegerich's highly critical review of the Red Book appeared in Spring in 2010. Therein, he roundly denounces Jung's foundational work, mordantly labeling it the New Bible, and declaring, quote, "It cannot, indeed ought not, reach the reading public," unquote. The New Bible was a Bible that should not be read. Then he continues, speaking of Jung's use of the word truth. Quote, "His word truth has nothing to do anymore with truth in the authentic sense," unquote. Truth in the authentic sense? Giegerich can discriminate truth in the authentic sense? Jung's truth is not truth. Those all sounded like the pronouncements of a theologian. Giegerich elsewhere describes Liber Novus as the, quote, "primitive form of a careless, sloppy scribble, contingent, fragmentary products," unquote. And these are views diametrically opposed to my own. Nonetheless, carefully considering his response to Liber Novus helps delineate and clarify the nature of Jung's psychology and how very different it is from the logocentric and entirely non-psychological psychology of Wolfgang Giegerich. In reading Giegerich, this distinction does eventually become obvious. And then, in the fall of 2010, issue of Spring, ostensibly an issue centered on Jung and Christianity, another long essay from Giegerich titled, "God Must Not Die," C.G. Jung's thesis of the one-sidedness of Christianity. Therein, he dissects the logical failure of Jung's supposed theologics of Christianity. Following after that paper, there was again a response contributed by Dr. David Miller. And Dr. Miller frequently adds cogent commentary to Giegerich, as he did for Hillman. Therein, David very insightfully and affirmatively aligned Giegerich's reading of Jung with a parallel development in radical postmodern Protestant theologics, as exampled specifically by the death of God theology of Thomas J.J. Altizer. And I think some of you in this room are probably old enough to remember the magazine cover on Time, "Is God Dead?" That's Thomas J.J. Altizer's theology when it hit in the 60s. And Miller was Altizer was in Ithaca and Miller was in Syracuse. So, you know, these are people that work together, colleagues, and Miller knows quite a bit about Altizer's theology. So that was an interesting that was an interesting turn. Hillman's essay in 1971 was a revolt against what he perceived as Protestant theology in Jungian psychology. And he had run up face to face with this at the Jung Institute in Zurich. Was Giegerich, as the new post-Jungian, circling back into radical Protestant theology? Well, Dr. Miller makes a strong case for this assertion. Then, in the fall of 2009 issue of Spring, there appeared an acerbic essay by Dr. Giegerich in which he responded to an earlier article by Robert Romanishin. Is that how you say his name? Romanishin? Do you guys know? Yeah. On ecology and psychology. And that article was titled Melting of the Polar Ice. And by the way, he came here to our Jung Society and gave a talk on this subject last year. Dr. Romanishin did. In his critique, Giegerich labeled Romanishin, who is a respected Jungian analyst and author, a, quote, repentance preacher and revivalist. Oh, a preacher. Both the content and the dismissive tone in Giegerich's article roused the animus of quite a few readers, apparently. In fairness, Spring published several of the negative responses to Giegerich's response to Romanishin. And in a well-articulated rejoinder, Susan Rowland, who is now a professor at Pacifica, previously a professor in England, Susan Rowland declaimed Giegerich as a monotheist, with absolutely no honor intended. A monotheist. Theology and an archetypal epithet, all in one word. And she writes, "My basic quarrel with Giegerich's dualism is that it is really monotheism, so that it takes no account of its real other, its other, the animistic and connected mythical scheme of reading the real. What Jung more than intuited, so that it formed the bedrock of his archetypal schema, was that modernity inherited an animistic legacy of great antiquity." Animistic. A soul legacy. An inherited soul story. A human legacy of great antiquity. Anima. Soul. Animism. Perception of a soul force that animates the material universe. And those are definitions, meanings behind that word. An animistic legacy of great antiquity. Rowland continues, noting that Giegerich's psychology of the soul is, quote, soul alone, severed from body, nature, emotion, and connection. Connection. Yet, Jung added and taught us to value Eros as body, connectedness, feeling, emotion. The path to truth cannot be restricted to one modern logic. We have a consciousness that is ego-centered, where we are knowing because we are part of nature. These structures of consciousness are multiple, multicultural, eco-psychological, and rooted in the psychoid mind-body union. Psychoid mind-body union, unquote. The path to truth cannot be restricted to one modern logic, so says Dr. Rowland. And in this, Rowland is very much in tune here with the Sophianic aspects of Jung's psychology. Quote, structures of consciousness are rooted in the psychoid mind-body union. And now we meet a flyer from Pacifica announcing notice of an upcoming lecture to be given by Dr. Sonu Shamdasani, which will be delivered in February at Pacifica, which is titled Jung's Theology of the Dead in Liber Novus. Jung's Theology. So as I walked around pondering the post-Jungians, those are the types of theological sparks that kindled a fire in my own considerations. And I can go on about this stuff. I've got another 20 pages of notes on Giegerich, but let's let's just leave it there. Perhaps you get my point, or Dr. Miller's point, or Hillman's point, or Giegerich's point. Monotheists and polytheists, theology and psychology. Theology in the Red Book. Repentance preaching. It seems the post-Jungian psychologies, and in their imperfect mirror, Jung's psychology, are reflecting theological shadows. Dr. Miller has been paying, David Miller has been paying attention to this issue. And throughout the last 40 years, he has added an influential, theologically informed perspective to post-Jungian psychology. And then referentially to its theologics. He has shared some of those insights with us here over the last 7 or so years that he's come and visited us. Monotheism, polytheism, theology. These are big words, and they cast long shadows. And so before turning the spotlight back to Sophia, we need to talk about these words and make some terminological discriminations. Can you see a relationship between psychology and theology? Is psychology more like theology or more like mythology? What is the distinction? Is one a logical truth, perhaps like Giegerich's authentic truth, and the other a perceptual falsehood, perhaps like Jung's falsely so-called truth, critiqued by Giegerich? This is a fundamental question. Let me put it another way. Does psychology properly find its foundation in precepts, in the structuring syntax of psychologics, or does psychology find its substance within the semantics of story and mythology? Restated, should we understand our soul science, our modern psychology, through conceptualizations derived from logical precepts, or in the semantic perception of mythic language, as expressed by story? Or both? Or neither? Is soul a precept or a perception? Is soul met in syntax or in its semantics? Now, these are two words that syntax, semantics, those are words that Giegerich made me think about. They're words he uses quite a bit. He thinks highly of syntax. And he suggests that Jung's psychology is stuck in an outdated semantics. Now, this vocabulary of syntax and semantics is drawn from linguistic theory. Syntax is the structure behind language, the structure giving structure to language. It's the rules or logic of forming language. For instance, Noam Chomsky argued, beginning back in the late 50s, that syntax, the logical structure of language, was somehow inborn and hardwired in the human brain, in human neurology of brain. So what's semantics? Semantics refers to the meaning of language, the meaning. And most theorists argue that these two core concepts are what one fellow described as orthogonal. They're at right angles to each other. They're different. They are different things. Different things. It is entirely unclear, and may remain always unclear, how they are related. Except they obviously do play together in human language. In the life of language, right? One can construct a syntactically correct sentence that is utterly devoid of meaning. It has a subject, a verb, an object, a subject, a predicate, however you wish to describe it, and it's devoid of meaning. One paper that I was reading in the Journal of Theoretical Linguistics, and that's how crazy I was about this stuff. I should tell you, actually, there was a paper I was looking for in the Journal of Theoretical Linguistics on semantics and syntax, and I didn't have the citation exactly. I just sort of remembered it was there. So I pulled up the university database, and I started going through the list of titles looking for this paper, and you can imagine the titles that come with papers in the Journal of Theoretical Linguistics, right? So I went through like five or six screens of these titles, and there in the middle of the screen, I was going to bring a picture of this, I didn't. There in the middle of the screen, I met, amongst all this jumble of words, I met the title that everyone has always wanted to put on their paper. The best title I have ever seen for a paper. There in the Journal of Theoretical Linguistics it was. The title was Just Fucking Brilliant. Personally, I thought the paper, when I saw the title, I thought, I have to read this. But isn't that the title everyone wants to put at the title at the top of their... And the journal published it. I was so impressed. Okay. Semantics and syntax. There's a syntax there, but the semantics, do you see the difference? I mean, it makes sense, and then it has all this multitude of meanings. Well, in the paper that I did eventually find, the fellow says, you know, an image of a syntactically correct sentence that has no semantics would be cows flow lumpily. Cows flow lumpily. Well, it's got a subject, cows. It's got a verb, flow. It's got an adverb, lumpily. It's syntactically correct, but it has no meaning.
It brings cow pies to mind.
And that is exactly what I thought. How did you know that?
We think alike about it.
And so I sat there looking at that, and I started thinking about cows flow lumpily. And it became a poem. Right?
Yeah.
I could see ways in which that, like cows flow lumpily, like cold mother's milk and grit. And all of a sudden, this syntactically correct but supposedly meaningless sentence, suddenly all of these images of meaning, referring that cold mother's milk and grit, that's something that David Miller talked about when he was here, something that Hillman had affirmed to him. Hillman was behind, he said, the cold mother's milk and grit. I thought about that term when he said it back then. But it all came together. It's like, oh yes, you see? But where was that semantics coming from? It wasn't in the syntax. The semantics, the meaning, was image, coming forth from me. Syntax. Semantics. Does that make sense? You get that?
Yeah.
Ruth.
Except I'm not sure I understand it. And that is, you know, my thought was, how can it not have meaning? Well, we're assuming, I get what you said, we put the meaning into it. But how can we assume there was no original meaning?
The fellow in this paper, I would answer, specifically tried to come up with a syntactical phrase as an example of his concept that to him had no meaning.
Okay.
But he's wrong, right?
But he's wrong, right?
I think he's wrong, because I don't think sentence has no meaning.
He's right and wrong?
I don't think you can have syntax without meaning, even when you go to the logical structure of f of x and f of y is something.
What's this effing stuff? Would you clarify that, please?
In logic, you take the structure of a sentence and you get it down to, you take a sentence and you get it down to something like a mathematical structure. And when you say f of x, that means like there isn't x that's f. It's like Karen is 54. Right, so there is an X, Karen, who is 50 or 40 years old, predicate. So you can have these kind of structures, but even when you boil it down to this mathematical structure, to me, I still see no meaning.
This is
it's a barest meaning, and then you fill it in more and more. The cows flow lumpily, your meaning, that's one way, cows flow lumpily, and it says so much about the world, right? The in and out, the nutrition, The guy's wrong. You just don't have.
Well, this is the sort of thing that people involved in linguistics have been arguing about since the 50s.
It reminds me, is it a wave or a particle? Depending on the observer.
Or like Stu said yesterday, matter and energy.
Is it the sentence that has the meaning, or the participant, the observer, that is bringing the meaning to the syntax?
Or is that a false dichotomy? Like syntax and semantics.
Mind, body. We're getting into co-op
here. So, logic, you see, logic is related to syntax. It has axiomatic theorems about the connection of things. And some people involved in linguistic theory would say those axioms are actually hardwired into neural structure of brain, logically present. The rules are there. The rules pre-exist language. Language forms in response to pre-existent rules. And the argument that Noam Chomsky made along this line is children learn language too quickly. If the syntax were not already there, the ways in which language could be made were not already hardwired in the brain, kids couldn't learn to speak so quickly. They couldn't understand so quickly. That's his argument. Now, there's been a lot of argument with that argument. Okay? That's 30 years of language and 30 years of linguistic theory in argumentation. Myth, however, is all semantics. Meaning. So, what is your psychology? Is your psychology syntactic? Or is your psychology semantic?
Why do you have to choose?
You don't. But think about it.
I was wondering if there's a parallel between these terms, semantics and syntax, and Jung's typology, such as thinking versus feeling, sensate versus intuition.
I would not go that way. I would say that those are also orthogonal, right-angle concepts. And in preparing this talk, that was a subject that I excised from discussion because it got really complex. But I'd say no, not. Okay, now let me play another angle on this. precept and percept. This is an issue that hit me while I was trying to type an email to a friend last month, talking to her about these issues. While I was typing, I would type the word percept, P-E-R-C-E-P-T, as in perception, but, and that is a real word, it's in the dictionary, but the automatic spelling correction software in my email program kept correcting the word percept, P-E-R-C-E-P-T, to precept, P-R-E-C-E-P-T. The damn computer had no perceptions about what I was trying to say. It did not perceive the difference between a precept and a percept. Nor apparently did the human who designed that software. Who knows? So precept. The word comes directly from Latin. Precapere. If you parse the word from Latin, it means pre, before, and capere, catching. Before the capture. Precepts. Before. Syntax. The rule that forms. Are there precepts, syntactical or logical rules that take us, that seize us before, that capture us? Do we think and act and imagine under prefigured laws, precepts of ordered reason? Are precepts the first thing, pre, before, in front of, in advance of, the primary things that order and fashion the manner in which we are captured by life? And what is the difference between a precept and a percept? Perception. Percept. Percapere in Latin. Per means through. If I give somebody a medicine to take, P-O, it means per, orum, by mouth, per, through. There are other ways that you can do these things too, you know, there are other pers. So per, through. And the per in Latin means through in the sense of in space, like through the mouth, in time, throughout, all over, per. It occurs frequently in Latin cognates of our language. Perceptions are taken in time, through space, throughout experience. So the question then is, are perceptions the children of precepts? Do we perceive because the structure is there, the concept, the rule is in us? We only can see what the precepts allow us to perceive. Are they preordained? Or are perceptions things we gather and capture in space and time and experience? You see, syntax is related to this word precept. It is the logically claimed a priori reason or order of things. Semantics, meaning, is perception. A formed meaning through. So in psychology, what are the axioms? what are the precepts? Are there any that seem universally valid? Or are we lost in a maze, thoroughly captured by our perceptions, our perceptive facts? Do we give first honor to the precepts, or do we give first honor to the perceptions? Do we give honor to the syntax or the semantics? Or are they orthogonal? They cross. They aren't the same. But somewhere, in some magic way, they touch. There's a center. These right angles cross. Is that where we live? In the center? What guides a therapist through the maze of human relationship? Precepts or percepts? Paula said something interesting. Gosh, it was a couple years ago, I think, to me. She said that when you first start work as a therapist, when you first see that patient, you sit down in a room with a patient, that the concepts, the rules, are the things you hold to as a safety net, trying to figure out what the hell is going on. But as time goes on, you relax. And not only that, experience sometimes fractures the precepts. Does it? Let me give you an example. Let's see if I've got time here. Yeah. So, I had permission to tell this story from my friend. I got a consult from a friend, a very, very close friend. And she has a very serious cancer. The cancer occurred 2.5 years ago or so, and the chance of her survival at that point, it was widely metastatic, was, I most people thought, her doctors and me too, thought she probably wouldn't make it 6 months. She went through a radical surgery that nearly killed her, then she had chemotherapy, and she had an almost complete remission. Throughout her chemotherapy, she really pissed off her oncologist because she's a frail person. She had been through terrible, you know, trauma in the surgery. And she knew that there were times when her body could not take the next dose of chemotherapy. It was, you know, the strongest chemotherapy you could possibly get. And she knew that there were times when she could not do it. And they were giving her a couple different drugs. And so she would go in for her chemotherapy and she'd tell the oncologist, "Today, I only want half as much of that. And I don't want any of this." That drove the oncologist crazy. And you know what? Her response was outside of the parameters of statistical survival. Well, this summer, fall, she had a recurrence. The enzymes or the hormones started going up, and they did the extra PET scan, and she found a little piece of tumor. And they knew they were going to have to take this out and then give her chemotherapy. And she went in and saw her oncologist, who seemed like he tolerated her the last time. You know, she went in, and he said, "Well, you know, at this point, we have three different chemotherapy agents after surgery that we can give you. And we've talked about this at the tumor board where they discuss these things, and it isn't really clear which of the three would be better." And the story to that is the reason it wasn't clear is because most people don't survive as long as she'd survived anyway. There aren't a whole lot of studies saying what's the next best thing to do after you've already done the best thing you could. And so she looked at him and said, "Well, could I then just go and see these? Could I hold each one of these three agents and see which one felt best to me?" And he got furious. I was like, "What? We can't do that. No. What's going on? What's going on there? Precept? Percept. What's the precept that medical science will choose?" "Well, excuse me, sir, you just told me that your science doesn't know how to choose." "Well, I'll choose. I'm the doctor. Precept. And what's her situation? Let me feel it. Let me see if I perceive. What's the next thing she's going to ask for? A tarot reading before chemotherapy? Yeah, maybe so. Or I Ching reading? I don't know. But is that the doctor's office stuff? So she was really devastated. And she called me on the phone and said, what do you think about this? What do you think? How do I handle this? What's going on here? And, you know, look, she's dealing with, I mean, life and death issues, right? And so my approach was, well, you tell me, is the doctor right? Is the patient right? What's right?
What does she have to lose?
What does the doctor have to lose?
His whole structure of his thinking.
Structure?
Authority?
And
her perception may be as well informed.
But what's his
precept?
What's his authority based on?
Well, on his ability to internalize precept and administer that through percept.
Statistics.
Statistics? Science. A science of statistics.
A science.
A science. A science. So.
And ego.
And ego too, probably. Except I think that, you know, the story, because I'd heard about this doctor, we've been talking throughout all this process, and I'd heard other things she'd said about him, and actually she had a pretty good opinion of him. Then that just broke something that day.
I would say that he has, I'm not able to distinguish these precept, percept, as though they can be separable. He's got both of them going on, and that is his science. And she has respect for that, but also has an opening of another worldview, and she's working through precept and percept as well.
Yeah.
When you decide to do that, you're not just feeling, you're not just perceiving. Mm-hmm. You're saying, this is an alternative way to get at something that might be fruitful, and that is a precept.
And I'm not saying they're different. I'm saying they're different axes, as you see. And I'm saying that they do cross. Yes.
Well, it seems to me it's a false distinction. It's like, we'll go back to quantum, which we know nothing about, but are they particles or are they waves? You can't understand them without both. And it may simply be that we slice the pie that way because of history, language, whatever it is, but it isn't really the way it works.
It isn't really the way it works.
Yeah.
One side or the other.
Yeah, I think that it, at least certainly in terms of how one, say, does therapy, which I do know something about, there are times when I find myself in the pre area.
Yeah.
And at other times in the per area, and sometimes then going back to the pre area to understand the per area. And so there is no there is no one way I would say works. And I think that there are a number of us in this room who would say the attempt to make it to make psychology or therapy pre is short-sighted, even though people who handle the money in all of this think it is the way to go.
They want the diagnostic precept to fit for the billing forms. Yes, isn't that the way it is?
In a lot of ways.
Go ahead.
I think I'm having some difficulty now with the concept of precept, as if it's hardwired and that's it. But if we think about the different levels you were talking about last evening, then there's an ongoing process that perhaps modifies that as well. So we're assuming that with these two concepts, that it's either, you know, something that was hardwired for her, you know, and therefore she's tuning into that, but that it's a one-dimensional. How one-dimensional is precept?
Good question.
For my analysis of this, I would back up and say that
science is a product of the ego-conscious, mm-hmm. ego-consciousness, and that perception would be a behavior or an action of ego-consciousness. This is my interpretation. Precept, I would see, is more Jungian in that it is an apprehension, apprende, of psychic material, of the archetypical images. So her behavior could represent that, whereas the doctor, I would say, his behaviors and his perceptions are based on ego consciousness. So that would be where the conflict would rise.
That actually circles back to something else that we deal with in interpretations of Jungian psychology. Are the archetypes a precept that Jung had, a concept of how things work, or are they a perception, an image that he had of what's back there that is experientially derived and not conceptually derived? Or did the concept cause the perception? Like Giegerich would say, the concept was in his head, and so then he had the experience as a result of the concept. Or did the concept arise as a result of the experience? It gets complicated.
I would say the precepts are more, from Jung's,
you think so?
More intuitive.
Yes.
And rather than reasoned.
More intuitive. And so is intuition one or the other? Or does it really make a damn bit of difference? Maybe it's something you just need to talk about and think about and then decide. It doesn't make a damn bit of difference. But you see, if you don't think about it, then you don't know that it doesn't make a damn bit of difference.
Do we have a precept in our culture, or perhaps built into human life? I don't like that idea, but that we have to say one is before the other, and that's why Sophia doesn't have great...
God created heaven and earth! What came first? The creating word. Well, that's one way of it.
Masculine.
Created. Well, maybe it was a she, but she had problems too.
But that voice.
But you teach. He opened his eyes and saw her.
Uh-huh.
Which means she was already there.
No, she took her elbow and gave him a hard one in the ribs. The guy was snoring. He was sick and tired of snoring.
But either way, we have a co-evil, and that co-ness that we're even talking about is still because we want to chop things up. We have a tendency, I think, in feeling and in thinking, to separate and distinguish its mind and its body, its feeling or its thought.
It's boy or girl.
Because we aren't comfortable with the sort of mystery of its being both.
Both, crossing, relationship. The relationship. The relationship is ambiguous and difficult and meaningful and structuring, and we live in it, the relationship. Let me just finish this last section, then we'll take a break. There is seldom agreement about theology. It is the type of thing that drives men to murder. Not so often women. Men to murder. Even murder of soul. It is a constant argument, strung out over history. And strung along the course of history are the corpses of those who lost the debate at any given time. But somehow, theology, disembodied, lives on. Modern language commonly defines theology as the systematic and rational study of the concept of God and religious dogma. And note the word, systematic, rational, and the word, logical. Western Orthodox theologies, both in Orthodox Judaism and Orthodox Christianity, and most particularly in the later forms of Protestant Christianity, shun myth. Theology is the logic of God, not the myth of God. Myths are lies. Theology is truth, with a capital T. Theology speaks in the syntax of divinity. It affirms history and the facts of foundational events. It strips away the myth, or what might be technically called the semantics of story, from the supposed facts. Or it concretizes story into history and myth into fact. From this axiomatic foundation, it develops rational precepts. These precepts are the foundation of its logic, its theologics of God. Theology is, at least in one feminist critique, erected of logic. It is relationship to a singularity, its own singularity. It is logocentric. Or said more evocatively, more French and linguistically, theology is an autoerotic service to phalo-logocentrism. That is one feminist critique. Okay? Thus, theology stands in opposition to mythology within the Western theistic tradition. Theology defines a syntax or logical method of formulation by which one reasoned about religious dogmas. Mythology was a semantics of story and of image, and open to manifold meanings. Consider it as a difference like that between syntax and semantics. In ancient Greece, however, the term theologia meant an account of the gods, a naming of the gods, whether legendary or philosophical. Stoic philosophy distinguished three kinds of theologia: mystical, rational, and civil. The last being knowledge of the due rights, civil rights, that one performed in a religion. Thus, in Greek culture, myth was one among several ways of speaking about the gods, or of giving their account, their story. Logic or rational discourse was another. But Christian theology underwent a narrowing of focus, particularly in medieval scholastic philosophy. And in the 12th century, Abelard applied the term theology specifically to the philosophical foundations of the doctrines of Christianity. Over the next century, this became the generally accepted focus of Christianity, or at least Christianity's theology. And theology became a department of academic study. And this went further with Thomas Aquinas a century later, who incorporated Aristotelian logic into theology, Christian theology. A few hundred years later, Protestant theology took the logical mandate of theology further with its utter rejection of image, icon, and myth. It peeled the onion until there was no onion. And that really was the result of Thomas J.J. Altizer's Death of God theology. He got to the core, and there weren't no core. Word, logos, and the book were the Protestant focus. Biblical text read as history and natural logic were the foundations of theologics. The logocentrism of monotheistic theologies gave little place of honor to the feminine in all the multiplicity implied by that gendered word. And this had cultural repercussions for women and for men and their relationship. Rejection of the feminine is manifest in theological aversion to mythopoeia, myth-making, the fluid life of myth, and the living experience of the imaginal. And, of course, the myth about a feminine form of deity immanent in matter found no place within the theologics of monotheism. This is a wounding and a division and a terrible shadow which has been borne forward by theologics. Jung found in Gnostic psychology an analog and an affirmation, an historical witness of his own experience and observations. Myth and image had reality. The psyche had a story, and it lived in us and with us and around us. A potential of thought experientially met its potential in image. Consciousness was engaged with myth and story, including its own story. Wolfgang Guidrich preaches about the soul's logical life. And this is the title of his principal work. His psychologics is all about the life of logic. Soul's life is part of logic. Psyche really disappears or is sublated into a logical construct. In Gnostic psychology, in distinction, the soul does not have a logical life. Soul has a life of its own. A life of its own. Soul can not be sublated, negated, and retained back into logic, or made function of mind. It is life, and that life cannot be subsumed into reason, or logic, or theologics, or precept, or syntax. She is life. There she is, Ding an sich. There she is, the fact of a relationship. She is the syzygy of the logos, mind, thought, and primal relationship. Neither was or is or will be without the other. Jung has been misread, if he is read, in the context solely of theologics. Jung has been misread, if he is read in the context of theologics. Theology has always misunderstood Gnostic mythology and psychology. 2,000 years of the historical record well evidence this fact. Jung's psychology cannot be parsed by theologics. His psychology resides in a different domain. Jung stood his psychology historically in a sociological tradition. Jung aligned himself with the tradition of psyche as experience, psychology as semantics of soul, reaching back across the millennia. He identified his ancestry. He said, "We cannot help being prejudiced by our ancestors." He chose his ancestors. They chose him. His psychology, along with Gnostic psychology, focused on relationship of two opposites. Relationship of two opposites. And the life in their union. Mind and image, logos, and Sophia. So let's stop there. Let's take a break. Maybe 15 minutes, and then we'll have another hour before lunch. How's that? Thanks, guys.